Well, we've talked about the Garden of Eden. We've talked about Adam and Eve. We didn't talk much about Cain and Abel, but a few months ago, I preached a sermon on Cain. We're going to move along a little bit in our skipping along through characters and events of the Old Testament. We're going to move all the way up to Genesis 7 and the story of a world washed clean. It's the story of the flood. It's one of the best-known stories in the whole Bible. The imagery of it just captures our imagination. We can just see it in our mind's eye, this huge ark made out of wood, filled with all the animals that walk the earth, floating high on a world of water. Children love it because the animals that fill the ark, by twosies, elephants and kangaroosies, and there's lots of children's toys, arks, and the animals, and the children playing with the animals in the ark and all that. It's a favorite story of children. For adults, we may have trouble taking that very seriously. The whole idea of a worldwide flood doesn't seem reasonable, almost impossible to even imagine. And although God's free to do anything he wants, the thought of God being so apparently cruel as to destroy every man, woman, and child and animal all over the earth except for a tiny remnant, it seems incompatible with the way he's revealed himself as a God of love and justice and mercy. But the flood narrative in these first few chapters of Genesis perfectly expounds some theological truths that apply not only to events that occurred in the ancient world, but in our world today. And unfortunately for many of us, our own personal experiences. To begin with, the story is kind of misnomered, I think. We call it the story of Noah's Ark, but more accurately, it's the story of God's Ark. It's a story of God's salvation. As the Bible tells the story, Noah, in fact, has a relatively minor role. He has a non-speaking part. For the entire 3.5 chapters of Genesis that tells the story of the flood, Noah doesn't say a single thing, not a single word in the text. The only ones who do say something are the narrator and God. And not surprisingly, through the years, our movement has kept the spotlight on Noah, and he is a great example. I mean, we've noted the text says Noah did this. He did all that God commanded him, Genesis 6:22. And Noah did all that the Lord had commanded him, Genesis 7:5. We notice, the faithfulness of Noah and building this great ark out in the middle of nowhere where there's no water because God told him to do it, and trusting God and doing it the way God told him to do it. And his role in this as embracing God's plan of salvation for himself and living it out in his life, again, a great example. We pick out the phrases that show Noah's obedience. Noah did this, he did all, and Noah did all. But I hope we can see that Genesis puts the emphasis on God, not on Noah. Noah was certainly God's human instrument, but God's commands, plan, and judgment on evil brought salvation to the whole creation, including the human race. Most of us tend to see the world the way an ant sees an elephant. It's only that minuscule portion in front of our own nose. Only our cares and concerns and our family and our job and our day and our house and all of our stuff is right there. That's the way we see the world and how it affects us. In the story of the flood, God is opening our eyes to a bigger picture, kind of his perspective on things to some degree. He wants to see that he created a world which is very good, but humans chose to turn their backs on goodness and on God himself, which plunged his beautiful creation down a sinkhole of selfishness, immorality, violence, and abuse. Genesis 6:5 through 7 tells us what happens. The Lord saw that the wickedness of humankind was great in the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made humankind on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. He had been so good, he had given us so much, he had blessed us with everything we needed, and look what we had done with it. It grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out from the earth the human beings I've created, people together with animals and creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. And the Bible narrative explains that although God made the world a place of peace, love, and beauty, humans through disobedience and rebellion had turned his world into a nightmare of abuse and violence against the weak and vulnerable. We should never forget what wickedness looks and feels like. The wickedness of humankind was great. What does that look like? I think it looks like the character of Jenny in the movie Forrest Gump, hiding in a cornfield from her abusive father, down on her knees pleading, "Dear God, make me a bird so I can fly far, far, far away from here." It looks like a real girl named Anne, an innocent young Jewish girl. She was also a gifted writer who kept a diary in which she recorded her daily experiences, as well as her dreams, her plans for the future, dreams of a good life, of a marriage, of having a family and children of her own someday. Anne Frank's diary has been read by millions of people. It's claimed to be the second most read nonfiction work of all time, second only to the Bible. She tells in her diary of how, when her family learned that the Nazis were rounding up Jews and confining them in concentration camps, they and a few others hid in the upper floors of a partly abandoned building. And for more than 2 years, they lived like rats in a cage. Anne's diary told of the inaction of the group, her fears, her own thoughts and dreams. And as the war drug on, the Nazis eventually found them and shipped them off to a death camp. Her German captors separated young Anne from her father and treated her mercilessly. She was given so little food that she developed scabies. Because of the ankle-deep mud she had to live, eat, and sleep in, she got typhus. She died just a few weeks before she would have been liberated. And her story is just one of 6 million stories. People exterminated without mercy simply for being Jewish. When evil reigns rampant, it needs to be stopped. Hitler and the Nazis' ambition was to eventually conquer the world. They would start with Europe and extend to Russia, North Africa, the Pacific, and here. Their violence and their ambition knew no limits. They had to be stopped, no matter the terrible cost of doing so. And as long as things are going well at the moment for me and my family, my friends, my job, I tend to think that the world's in good shape. But God sees everything. He sees Jenny down in that cornfield on her knees. He sees Anne Frank and her family holed up, hiding. In Noah's time, it was as if, the Bible says, it was as if Hitler and the Nazis had won. Only evil continually. The wickedness of humanity was limitless. And the picture we get of the Nazis' treatment of the Jews is something like the way people were being treated, especially the most vulnerable people, women, children, the old, the ill, the most vulnerable people, only evil continually. And a big flood, what a great way to wash away all the child abuse and rape and neglect and racial violence and deceit, hatred, murder, selfish pride, sexual perversion, torture that was taking place all over the world. In the story of the flood, God means for us to see the world as he does, not the way the ant sees the elephant. God wants us to see things in their entirety as the creator who made both the ant and the elephant sees them. But we need to see something else too. 600 years, according to the story in the Bible, 600 years before the flood, God was already putting in place a plan of salvation. We don't hear the words plan of salvation much these days. The story of Noah can help us think about what that phrase involves. A few years ago, Connie and I had the opportunity to camp on the lower portion of Mount Rainier in Washington State. It's one of the most beautiful, biggest mountains I've ever seen. Especially if you see it from like Puget Sound, you're at sea level, you're looking up over 14,000 feet to this massive thing. It's at a relatively high latitude, and its summit is covered year-round with snow and glaciers. It's also very popular with climbers. It's not that difficult to climb for such a tall mountain. Connie and I hiked a short way on the snow and ice that summer that we camped there. But if you want to climb to the summit, there are a lot of safety recommendations to consider. And the first one ought to be obvious to everybody. Do not go if there's a chance of a blizzard. People die every year climbing Mount Rainier. So when a group of climbers gets caught in a blizzard on Mount Rainier, which happens far too often, it's mostly their own fault. They should have looked at the weather forecast, and when they saw the forecast, they shouldn't have started. And rescuing someone during a blizzard on Mount Rainier can itself lead, and often does lead, to additional fatalities. So a rescue team needs a plan of salvation, so to speak. They're going to go rescue somebody during a blizzard on Mount Rainier. The rescue attempts are so dangerous, so expensive, that many people have said over the years, and some of us might agree with them, that if people choose to climb Mount Rainier in bad weather, then they're on their own. Why risk other lives? Why go to the expense and trouble to try to save them? They just have to face their own consequences. Well, God very well could have said, I guess, that same thing about the human race. He had given us everything, and look what we had done with it. But what if those caught on Mount Rainier during a storm were members of your family or of mine or friends? Wouldn't we ourselves get busy on a plan to save them no matter what? And that's the way God feels about everyone. So even before God decrees the flood to wipe out the evil that's torturing his creation, he's already put a plan in place, a plan of salvation in motion. He's already selected Noah. God picked him out from his birth, the way he later picked out Moses to save Israel from slavery in Egypt. Genesis 5:29 comments on Noah's birth. Lamech, his father, named him Noah, saying, "Out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our work and from the toil of our hands." And so I don't have time this morning to talk about all Noah's years of obedient building, the gathering of all the animals, Noah and his family entering the ark, God himself shutting the door, the falling rain, the rising water, the ark rising up on the water, saving everyone on board. You may have seen Michelangelo's painting of the flood, in which the sufferings of the drowning people are portrayed so vividly. He was an incredible artist, but I think he did the Bible a little disservice in that instance. Because if God wanted us to focus on the suffering of the condemned, it would have been described in at least some minor detail. The Bible mentions that the wicked drown, but God keeps the attention, the focus, on the wonder of the ark and its cargo, floating safely above the cosmic deluge. Genesis 7, 17 and 18. The flood continued 40 days on the earth, and the waters increased and bore up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters swelled and increased greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the face of the waters. The way the narrator tells the story, he means to impress us with God's providence in saving Noah and the earth's creatures while washing the world clean of sin. In the New Testament, Peter refers to the flood as saving waters. It says in 1 Peter 3, 20 and 21, God waited patiently in the days of Noah during the building of the ark, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were saved through water. And baptism, which this prefigured, now saves you, not as a removal of dirt from the body, but as an appeal to God for a good conscience, through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And without covering up God's judgment of sin, the Bible puts the focus on God's salvation. So you come to the climax of the story. And you can imagine the scene. It's not described as though Noah and his family were the only people left after a nuclear holocaust where the living envy the dead. Rather, it's a beautiful green world, clean and whole and ready for new life. And when Noah emerges, there's a sense of helpful gratitude and blessing. Life begins all over again. Genesis 8, 20 and 21, then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing odor, the Lord said in his heart, "I will never again curse the ground because of humankind, for the inclination of the human heart is evil from youth. Nor will I ever again destroy every living creature as I have done." There's a paradox there. In a sense, nothing has changed. People's hearts are still inclined to do evil, but for the first time since Eden, God performs a unilateral act of divine grace. He makes an unconditional covenant with Noah and his descendants. Chapter 8, verse 22, as long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. And rather than being contaminated as after a nuclear holocaust, the world is cleansed by God's righteous act of judgment. And God said to Noah in chapter 9, verse 13 through 15, I've set my bow in the clouds, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I'll remember my covenant that's between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. When you see a rainbow today, do you think of a pot of gold? Do you think of the color spectrum? Or do you remember the promise that life will continue as long as the earth exists? It will continue no matter what the storm it endures. That doesn't mean that God will not stop the Hitlers, the haters of the world. It just means that as long as time endures, God's salvation from such evil will be done in a way that doesn't destroy all the innocent along with the guilty. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings trilogy basically tells the same story. It tells the story of how evil can be so horrible, so pervasive, that it can't, you must confront it. And it must be defeated no matter the terrible cost for the sake of those who are victimized by it. It was my favorite, it's my favorite fictional work. I don't know how many times I've read that trilogy, but it's several. I remember the first time I read it as a young teenager, and I remember being dismayed by the way it ended. So I'm shocked and saddened by what happened after Frodo finally, at such incredible cost, destroyed the ring and made his way back to his precious Shire with his friends. Instead of a triumphal entry and a parade and they lived happily ever after, evil had already taken root there and had to be uprooted once more. It was as if the story really never ends. When evil arises and it's confronted and it's defeated, it isn't really defeated. It's set aside for a moment, but it just comes right on back. Almost immediately it comes back. In fact, in the same chapter, just the next paragraph, after God makes this beautiful promise, a seed is sown for racial discord and oppression all over again. Just the next paragraph. I remember hearing that World War I was the great war, the war to end all wars. That didn't last long. And then World War II, you know, the whole world, evil's defeated. Can't make it a decade without another war. Evil is defeated. What do you do about this problem? When evil arises and people are being abused and mistreated and taken advantage of and coerced and controlled and killed, you defeat it and it won't stay down. It comes back over and over again. And I have to tell you, that's a story of my life too. When I engage in spiritual warfare against something in my life and I have a victory, the very next, it's almost thought, another war begins. It's not over. That's the way our spiritual battles go. And I wonder if maybe that's part of the reason for the story of the flood in our Bibles. And here you have a world full of evil. And God confronts it and destroys it and washes the world clean. But it doesn't stay clean. What was really accomplished there? The answer is in a final, eternal victory. The answer is in the gospel of Jesus Christ. So sacrifices don't have to be offered daily as a sin. It's a once for all, eternal sacrifice. And the final story, God's final story, his plan of salvation for humanity, for the entire creation, puts evil to an eternal end. And goodness only lives forever. That's our hope. That's our goal, it's our destiny. It's and we get invited like Noah was invited to be a part of God's plan of salvation, to embrace it for ourselves, and to make it our life's work and passion and ministry. And so we invite you this morning, if you haven't already become a part of that, to accept Jesus, to follow his call in your life and commit your life to making him your Lord in baptism, taking on his identity, becoming his child, and a part of his plan of eternal salvation. If you're subject to that call, come as we stand and sing.